alive, our consciousness is affected. There is this thing going on, what is called
the news, brought to you live.
You're listening to Off the Air on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. We're 15 days into the month of March, and tonight we bring you an exclusive presentation here on Off the Hour as we look at police brutality across Canada as well as in the Middle East on this sixth year that an International Day of Protest and Solidarity has been organized against police brutality. March 15th was first designated a day of action against police brutality in 1997 as an initiative of the Black Flag Collective in Switzerland, along with the help of COBP, which is the French acronym of the Collective Opposed to Police Brutality, right here in Montreal. Tonight we'll bring you reports from British Columbia, Alberta, Manitoba, Ontario, and we'll conclude right here in Quebec, where the action is just getting underway in Montreal at Barrie Square. That's near Metro Barrie. We'll be right back with the latest reports from actions around the world. Stay tuned. This is CKUT 90.3 FM. You can reach us by phone at 514-398-4616 or log on to www.ckut.ca to find out more about who we are. We'll be right back.
Mama, good day. I hope that when these few lines reach you, they may find you in the best of health. Mama, I really don't know how to tell you this, 'cause I did make a solemn promise to take care of little Jim and try my best to look out for him. Mama, I really did try my best, but nonetheless, I'm sorry if I tell you, sir, poor little Jim get a rest. It was the middle of the rush hour, when everybody just a hustle and a bustle to go home for them evening shower. Me and Jim stand up waiting for a bus, not causing no fuss, when all of a sudden a police van pull up. Out jump three policemen, all of them carrying baton. Them walk straight up to me and Jim. One of them hold on to Jim, say him taking him in. Jim tell him to let go of him, for him not do nothing, and him not a thief, not even a button. Jim start to wriggle, the police start to giggle. Mama, make I tell you what them do to Jim. Mama, make I tell you what them do to him. Them thump him in him belly and it turn to jelly. Them lick him pan him back and him rib get pop. Them lick him pan him head, but it tough like
the issue for today is police brutality.
This is a special edition for Hala Ya Hala, and we have here, other than me and Hala, we have Ahmed Abu Safiya, the SPHR president for McGill. We're talking about police brutality under military occupation in Palestine specifically. And here we have Ahmed Abu Safiya, who has personal experience and as well has personal information about this. And
so we're going to come right back to that interview here at CKUT 90.3. First, a report on actions that are happening around the world on this International Day Against Police Brutality. In the United States, activists are demonstrating across the states from New York to San Francisco, and around the world, people are rising up in Belgium, Russia, France, Switzerland, Austria, Argentina, and New Zealand. But first, we turn to Winnipeg, Manitoba, where actions were held today to celebrate the diversity of community resources and networks there, while in Calgary, Alberta, social justice and anti-poverty groups marched to police headquarters. I spoke with Donna from Calgary and Kirk from Manitoba yesterday.
Hey, my name is Donna McPhee, and I'm from Calgary, and we're participating in the International Day of Protest and Solidarity Against Police Brutality. We have an issue that we've been working on. Juan Melendez, he was beat by the police severely, and he was a SAIT student just walking home and sort of walked into a hooker sting or something. But they beat him severely, and we'd like a review on it, on Juan's, on the aspect of how the police are, what responsibility they'll take, as well as the G8 is coming here, and seeing the protests all over the world and all the police and the drumming on the bantams, it's scary. It's scary to be in a democracy where you're scared to use your voice or body to say no. And if we can't do that, then where's a democracy? In Calgary, the police association are in negotiation with wages, and they're all wearing baseball caps and looking like the tactical team already. So it's scary with what's coming up in Calgary.
Kirk, you want to go ahead?
Oh, yeah. My name is Steve Kirk, and I've been working with the local Coalition Against Police Brutality here in Winnipeg. In Winnipeg, 911 is a joke has been front page news for about 6 months now, perhaps longer. There's been an incident of two Aboriginal women who died due to police negligence in that case, not responding to repeated calls for to 911. So that is, I guess, on everybody's mind here. This is the fifth year that we've had a demonstration to on the International Day Against Police Brutality, March 15th. So we'll be meeting at or gathering at the Remand Center here, which is this is the institution where arrestees are held before their court appearances. So we'll be gathering there to show our sisters and brothers inside that they have people who remember and are working for them on the outside. And from there, we'll be walking to Old Market Square, which is a green space adjacent to the so-called public safety building here in Winnipeg, where there will be a vigil at 6 o'clock to honor the memory of all victims of police violence. Representatives from the Native Youth Movement and elders will be on hand to honor that memory.
Can you both comment on the coalition of groups that are behind the specific actions in your hometowns? Donna, if you want to go.
Okay. The Calgary Coalition for Social Justice, which formed around the Juan Melendez case and then broadened to look at internalized racism as we go, were the Alberta Coalition Against Poverty is involved, the Calgary District Labor Council, Calgary Union of Postal Workers, Latin American Community Association, and the Canadian Labor Congress Anti-Racist Forum.
There's been a broad coalition here as well. Members of the Anarchist Black Cross, members of Food Not Bombs, Native Youth Movement, support from the local workers organizing resource center, have all been active in solidarity and offer worked with the coalition here as well. So yeah, there is a broad there is a diverse community of a coalition of people who are coming together on this issue. Obviously, or in Winnipeg, I think the issue of racism, especially against the Aboriginal population, is front and center. I mean, it's front page news here. So that obviously is a strong presence in our coalition. Yeah.
What do you two both think about having a day against, an international day against police brutality? Is there a necessity for the day because of, for example, the way mainstream media treats police brutality?
Well, in our coalition, we got advised that we couldn't use brutality, that what was used was just a misunderstanding. It's not police brutality. There's happenings every day. I wait for the bus, I take the bonus, and in 10 minutes they're throwing around three youth hitting the ground and three policemen on them over a marijuana cigarette when they're growing in Flin Flon, Manitoba. It's the police have to remember they're part of the community, and no matter what, we're all going to be here.
Well, I mean, obviously, this is something. This is day to day. I mean, obviously, this is an ongoing power relation. That, you know, if you're gonna allow people to walk around. But I think it is really important that we have built this that this tradition is growing of a day. That we take one day specifically to show and demonstrate that yes, we are aware of it. Yes, we are going to, you know, to work on it so I do think it is important to honor March 15th as a day just to be public about it. And I think there is a growing awareness on a number of different levels that this is going on. I don't think that the various police forces are increasingly less able to hide behind, oh, this is just an isolated incident. You know, the patterns are becoming aware to a large number of people. So I do think that awareness of just is growing.
When the police force, like I deal in the low end of the city, and when the police force are like the corporate police force, it's like a move along police force. The homeless have nowhere to go. The business community wants downtown again, and they say, the homeless want to take over downtown. No, they're stuck downtown because there's no homes anywhere.
Yeah.
There's no affordable housing.
Yeah.
So the police, if they have to be part of the community, not bought off by the corporations.
Kirk, that's the same experience that you're having in your community in Manitoba?
Yeah, things are, you know, like the last couple of weeks, or just last week, front page news had police closing down whole blocks of the city, looking exactly or dressed in, you know, the paramilitary uniforms.
I wonder if either of you would care to comment on the relationship between police brutality as it exists in your communities and the increasing militarization that we see now in the world after the September 11th attacks in the United States.
I think every person of color is targeted since September 11th. People seem to think they have permission to debate your nationality on the street. If you're dark, then you're either a terrorist or, and that means the Aboriginal community. The Canadian government has called the Aboriginal community terrorists before, and with Bill 35 and Bill 36, the police are just getting more and more power, which is really scary for activists as well as individuals themselves. And a lot of people don't really can't affiliate with the issues until they are affected by the police directly.
Yeah. I do think that it is really important to be aware of the fact that there is other power other than that of you know, a man standing there with a gun. I mean, in the wake of September 11th, you know, the whole world, it seems like, was on the same page thinking about that incident, and everybody's thinking about, you know, the war in Vietnam, and it's just constant images of that type of struggle. And I think it is really important for us as community, as positive communities, as communities working to end violence, to end police violence, to be aware that we have power in a different form, and not to get drawn into that. You know, like, there's nothing the media would, nothing in my estimation, there's nothing the police like more than to see a bunch of anarchist or native youth on the streets so they can go out and club them, you know. And I think it's really important for us as anti-violent activists to remember that we have power in a different form, in the form of community, in the form of you know, there's mothers bringing their children to this to the event to show them, you know, mm-hmm. that we have people working together. We'll have we're planning on sharing food and sharing tea, and to demonstrate that, you know, not to get drawn into that realm, because, you know, that you know, how can you even pretend to be on that level, you know, like. So I think it's the one thing that is going on here is just a definite attempt to work creatively and work positively and not get drawn in to that military aspect of struggle. You know, that's we're struggling here with that day to day.
Does that struggle for community there, Donna, hit home in Calgary?
It's Calgary. Well, you have to realize Calgary is a rich city, as well as a really, we're getting more and more homeless all the time. I think that's why we're all joining together, like the church, like especially with the G8. There's a meeting that have never went to like environmental meetings or activist meetings before. So it's talking to the unconverted, which is really different.
Yeah.
And it's exciting. It's getting to be exciting times. And silence is consent. If we disagree with something, we have to say we disagree with it.
I agree with what you're saying. I think there are strong voices for that kind of community dealing with these problems on a community level. So that ultimately, or that eventually, people won't feel like they have to call some outside force to deal with violent situations in their neighborhood or their homes, you know, that there is that support from other members of the community rather than having to rely on some kind of centralized institution.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that, I mean, to work towards that is obviously what we're struggling for. So yeah, and it's hard sometimes to remember, you know. So, but I think we have to keep that creativity in the things we do. Otherwise, we just burn out, and that's what they want. You know, they want to see activists get burnt out on constantly worrying about security culture. You know, like that feeds. You know, like there's a stroller sitting here that says, "Support the cops, beat yourself up." And I think that's what they want, is to see us go down in terms of worrying about, or you know, worrying. Yeah. So it's and I'm always thankful for all the members in or all the relations in family and community that are around to remind us of the important things, you know.
Welcome back to the station. This is the special edition of Hala Ya Hala, and we are talking about police brutality under military occupation. And with regards to what we just heard, I mean, it seems to be that there are three underlying themes with police systems and police brutality all over the world, being number one, systemization of racism, number two, increased militarization of the police, and number three, the victimization of the youth. And this is especially pertinent with regards to what we're going to be talking about with Ahmed, who is the president of McGill's SPHR. Now, Ahmed, I've heard that there's this new law that has been passed, something about, I think it was number...
Military Order 132.
132. Could you tell us a little bit more about what this is all about?
Yes. Military Order number 132 was re-implemented by Israeli army, which the law exactly states that you can arrest, it basically allows the arrest of Palestinian children from 12 to 14 years of age. And this order, which was originally issued in 1967 and heavily implemented during the First Intifada, ceased to be enforced after the signing of the Declaration of Principles in 1993. However, after Prime Minister Ehud Barak entered the office, the military order was reinstituted, and one result of this has been the recent detention of several 14-year-old children. As the head of the Palestinian Prisoners Club, Isa Araa, he confirmed recently that more than 50% of all those arrested and detained by Israelis during the recent Intifada have been children.
So this is when we come to the subject of when does it stop being an issue of public security, and when it starts being an issue of terrorizing a nation or terrorizing a people and subjugating them to intense pressure by taking in the youth as to a way of weakening the people themselves. So if you tell us a little bit also about before the Intifada and after, that is the First Intifada, the increase in militarization and in police brutality, if you can bring us some statistics.
Well, yeah, and especially with regards to Israeli police being present on Palestinian land and what their role has been throughout history, just briefly.
Well, let me just give a very brief history outline of the whole region, especially the occupied territories. I'm going to start in 1993 Oslo Agreement, you know, at that time Israel starting dismantling all their police stations and in Gaza Strip and in some areas in the West Bank, which is entitled called Areas A's. And those areas, you know, since 1993 till the second Intifada has started, September 2000, most of those police stations were dismantled and Palestinian police stations were put in place, you know, of that. But after September 2000, when the second Intifada started, you know, Israel started bombarding those police stations, Palestinian police stations, and reoccupied most of that area. And now there is military occupation along with police forces by the state of Israel in the occupied territories of Palestine. And I have to also say that there is a very thin line between, you know, army and police, you know, Israeli, like, that is very hard to distinguish. So when we be talking, you know, it's very hard to also say police or army because it's almost similar.
They blend in. It's hard to draw the line because it becomes that a nation is being subjugated to security of another nation.
Exactly, yeah. So I'm going to give a brief statistics about the number of people who got killed. Let's look back at the 1987, the first Intifada, okay? Mm-hmm. Between the 9th of December 1987 and 9th of March 1988, the number of children who died was 25 child, okay? And the 11 of those 25 were died by a gunshot, a direct gunshot, you know, like they shot them, you know. But
so these weren't kids who were caught in the crossfire, they were actually stopped by...
I mean, these are not kids that present any kind of... security problem, threat.
Course not, you know. Yeah. Those children, when I'm talking about children, I'm talking about people under the age of, you know, 18 years old, but mainly, you know, when I looked at those statistics, I found out that most of those children are between the age of 12 and 14, you know, not even close to 18, which is very scary, you know, like to find such statistics. But let me get back to the point that if we look now, you know, at the year 2000, the second Intifada, between 29th of September 2000 and 31st December 2000, there is 49 Palestinian children got shot, you know, killed basically by the Israeli forces, whether it's army
police
or police,
or
you know,
both altogether,
yeah. You know, but we can see a doubling in the number, mm-hmm. which shows an increase, you know, in the forces they're using, in the, you know, there is a clear development in the way, the tactics that they're trying, you know,
the Intifada,
an upscale of police brutality,
yeah, of course, yeah.
Okay, and let's talk a little bit about in East Jerusalem and in Hebron, about police stations there and police security and police brutality, because they do go all hand in hand, obviously.
Yeah, if we look at the West Bank, you know, it's an area that is a bit more complicated than Gaza Strip. The West Bank, there is a clear infiltration of Israeli settlements and Israeli areas, and Israel made sure to control that area and to keep it secure by putting a lot of police stations, a lot of forces.
And
they
are Israeli police stations or Palestinian?
Israeli police stations, okay. You know, of course, you know, and which is very, you know, I would say pathetic, you know, how another nation controlling, you know, another nation.
Well, it's colonized.
But they're still it's an occupied territory, and it's the tactics of war. So
exactly.
It makes sense in one way, but in another, it's been a long time.
Yeah, and it's you know, like clearly, you know, those areas there is now, you know, at this time, you know, there's police stations that belong to Israel, you know, mm-hmm. and Palestinians when they need any kind of help or anything, you know, they go to those specific. You know,
okay, so it's basically Palestinians going to Israeli police stations, asking them to reinforce sometimes to help them or reinforce security in a certain way. But
exactly.
What ends up? Let's talk about some of the case studies I've read over of children being basically beaten up or maybe pushed around and in the occupied territories.
Yeah, I just want to talk about this case study. It belongs to a child. His name is Nimr Yusri Yunus Salhab, and he was born in 1982. And the story of this kid is that he was playing soccer in Hebron, you know, in an area called Asahli neighborhood. It's in the old city in Hebron. And this kid was playing soccer in that area when a settler approached him and started harassing him. And at that time, you know, two more kids approached, you know, Nimr, tried to help him. But the settlers start, you know, beating them up. And the settler was 40 years old, actually, you know. Yeah, 40 years old. After a while, the kids went to a police officer, an Israeli police car that was nearby, to complain to what happened. So the police officer called in more forces. I really can't understand why, like, you want to call more forces since there's only one settler in that area. Like, you know, why we don't call more police cars? But anyway, they called more forces and they went to that area and they arrested the children, the three children, you know, that were in that region, even though that the settler was the one responsible, you know, for he was the one starting the whole attack and, you know, causing the whole trouble. And anyway, after they took those three children to the police station. And meanwhile, in the way, when they went to the police station, they found the settler in the police station. Apparently, they let him go and, you know, go to the police station and wait there. So what happened is that they start questioning the Palestinian children about, you know, what did they do? Why did they harass the settler? So they kept on always saying that we did not harass him. He harassed us, you know, we're playing soccer peacefully. But anyway, like, you know, now the issue comes into play where they were forced to sign a paper that was written in Hebrew, you know.
Which they couldn't read or
which
understand.
Which they couldn't understand completely. They couldn't understand. But they were forced to.
How were they forced into it?
Well,
what are the usual tactics?
Their tactics is, you know, like the screaming and shouting and... You know, promising them something, like they told them, if you sign it, you're gonna leave, okay? Even though, like, they're children and they don't know what's exactly is going on, and so they signed it without them knowing what's going on. It was written in Hebrew, and later on they discovered that, you know, this paper was, you know, stating that I did harass that settler, you know.
And what happened to the kids?
The kids apparently, you know, left the police station after their parents had to pay $300 American to the police station to release those kids. And the police station told them that there is a court coming up for you guys, and they're waiting till this moment for the court.
Okay, well, with that story, we're going to come back with some more with Ahmed, president of SPHR McGill.
If you could tell us about the demonstrations that happened in Toronto today, the groups that were behind them, and the issues that were at the forefront of today's demonstration there.
Okay, well, it's actually kind of interesting because there's actually a lot of events happened in Toronto today on real short notice. And what we had today, we started out at 1 p.m. We had a demonstration outside the police headquarters, which is in downtown Toronto. And some of the issues we were trying to bring to the table were end to racial profiling, stop the Safe Streets Act and community action policing, which is a program that they have here, which basically means more money for cops to be harassing people in their homes, on the street, and things like that. So that's another demand. Issues like that is what we brought to the table. Beyond that, just at the demonstration, we also had two court dates today. I don't know if everyone in Montreal knows about the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, but OCAP's an organization that's been doing a lot of anti-poverty work in Toronto, in the downtown area, and in other areas outside of Toronto. And 2 years ago, June 15th, 2000, we had a demonstration outside Queen's Park, and it basically turned into a police-initiated riot where the police attacked the demonstrators, and the demonstrators fought back. And over the course of what happened, a whole lot of people got arrested, myself included. But what happened today, the two of the people who were arrested were in court for sentencing because they were convicted for charges and they're in for sentencing. So that was part of what we did too, is we organized people to go to their court case to show court support for them. And it was, I mean, they were already convicted, but what was a victory is the fact that they didn't get any jail time. Both of the people got about a year's probation and community service hours. So that's another thing that happened today. Beyond that, the demonstration just wrapped up. After the demo, we walked up to the coroner's office. And what happened, the reason we went there is because Pierre George, who is the brother of Dudley George, a native man who was shot by the Ontario Provincial Police in 95, he's been pushing to get a public inquiry and into the death of his brother to get some of the issues out on the table. And another thing that he's been working on is getting a coroner's inquest into the death. Right, so we went down. After that, we went with him. He was one of our speakers. We went with him. A whole group of us went up to the coroners to address the coroners, you know, to tell the coroner that we expect a response. We want to know if you're going to follow up with this, and so that's another part of what happened today.
About how many folks showed up in Toronto for the International Day Against Police Brutality, and what is the reaction of the mainstream media been there?
Well, about 100 people showed up for the demonstration outside police headquarters. On top of that, there in the two court dates, there was probably about 20 or 30 people in each of the court dates, which were happening at the same time that happened earlier on. And I'm actually right outside the coroner's office right now. There's still about a group of 30 people outside just waiting for Pierre to come out. So, I mean, the response is good on such short notice. As far as mainstream media, I think I'm going to have to wait a little bit longer to see in the news how they cover the event. But as far as, like, coverage, there's a lot of the mainstream media was here, you know, with cameras and they're interviewing some of the organizers. So hopefully we're going to get coverage, and hopefully it's favorable. I mean, we'll see. But, I mean, that's where community media comes in to tell our side of the thing, I guess.
Hey, Chris, can you tell us about the demonstrations that are being planned for later in the day in Vancouver and possibly some of the actions that are being planned there with the diversity of groups that are working on this International Day Against Police Brutality?
Right. Sure can, Gretchen. Last night, we started off by attending a public forum in the West End of Vancouver on community policing. And we've had 8 years of community policing in this city. And I think there's a number of people who are growing their consciousness around the role of community policing here. As you probably are aware through national media reports, we have between 50 and 90 women, sex trade workers, who are missing, all presumed murdered. And what we have, a lot of these people work in our community in the lower part of Grandview Woodland, which is in East Vancouver. And yet we have a community policing office that is solely focused on anti-panhandling. They're worried about garbage in the park and graffiti. So, and they say that these are safety issues. But what we've been doing is we've been turning up at their meetings and we've been saying, look, these are maybe safety issues for a very small minority of business and property owners. But where we live, one of the poorest neighborhoods in the country, for most people, the safety issues center around the lack of any support whatsoever to deal with, you know, basically a modern-day Jack the Ripper who's been running around here, and nothing gets done. Now, we turned up in the West End last night. A meeting had been called by the gay and lesbian community over the murder of Aaron Webster, who was a gay man, had been murdered in Stanley Park, and it was a terrible incident. But what worried us is that, you know, a lot of these women that are missing in the downtown east side also are lesbian, and there was no meeting, there was no public outcry. And we can't understand the call by the Vancouver police for gays and lesbians to join the community policing movement. So we went there, we distributed pamphlets, we talked about the history of community policing. 8 years of it in Vancouver has not stopped sex trade workers from being murdered, kidnapped, beaten. There was a study released by a group of prostitute advocates in Vancouver. It was funded by the BC Ministry of Women's Equality, and it found that the police had been extorting sex from a minor, from sex trade workers, forcing sex without condoms, and in some instances rape. And yet that never gets talked about. So when we bring it up, it obviously disturbs a lot of people. In these post-9/11 days, cops have got this new status as heroes. Nobody wants to hear the real stuff that happens at street level.
Do you find that's the same in Toronto there?
I mean, yeah, it's definitely the police, you know, the same thing, the police are seen as heroes, and I think that goes even before the 9/11 stuff, but it definitely has been strengthened by that. I mean, no one wants to talk about these issues that's actually happening. Everyone just wants to put more money to the police and just say, okay, you know what? We live in, you know what I'm saying? It's like people think that crime is on the rise. People think that all these issues are up there, you know what I mean? The media is putting out this idea. But no one wants to actually get down to the real issues of where the problems are and how we can actually solve them, you know what I'm saying? And like, I mean, we were talking, one of the people who were speaking for us was someone from Stop the Choppers. And as, I don't know if with what's going on in Vancouver, Montreal around this, but the police in Toronto have been pushing for years that they want helicopters, right? And you know what I'm saying? And we're talking about, well, the fact that the helicopters aren't gonna solve the problem, and there's not the money to provide for that, when they're saying that there's no money for youth programs, there's no money for dealing with these issues before it comes to the level where the police are coming into play. You know what I'm saying?
So, and those helicopters don't come cheap. They're like $1 million a pop.
No, they want to spend a bag of money on just one helicopter when all that money could be rerouted into very different kind of things, like programs for youth, programs for street people living on the streets. You know what I'm saying? Like it makes sense to me, and I'm sure it makes sense to all your listeners to prevent issues before they come up. But no one wants to deal with that. They just want to give the police more money and just wipe the problem off the street. You know what I'm saying? Without actually dealing with the real issues. You know.
Well, both of you have raised the issue of September 11th and the way it has raised. Police work on up on this platform. You can't speak badly about police officers because, you know, they're out there and they're protecting us. Chris, I wonder if you can comment on the difference between this International Day Against Police Brutality in relationship to past International Days Against Police Brutality, at least the actions that have happened in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm. Well, 2 years ago, we had an outstanding march in the downtown east side, which is Canada's poorest neighborhood. Also, it has Canada's largest concentration of urban Aboriginal peoples. And that was an outstanding march. It was we had upwards to 1,000 people at Main and Hastings, locally known as Pain and Wastings, where we have our open drug scene, and folks regularly die on the streets. We set up a pig pen right in the middle, and we threw donuts in and we jumped on them. And we did this to draw attention in the city to how the police have a role in contributing to the deaths of drug users. When they pinch and they take away the known dealers and put them in jail, it forces these users to go to unfamiliar sources, and that's when they overdose. In June, I think, of last year, we had 44 overdose deaths on the street, and it can be directly attributed to some of the police actions. So we wanted to draw attention to the role the police have in basically a quiet genocide towards our most poor and vulnerable members of the community.
What about you, Mike? How is past International Days Against Police Brutality different from this year's because of September 11th and the attacks there in the United States?
I mean, honestly, that's a tough question to answer, because I think one of the things we're looking at for today is that in Toronto for the last couple of years, a lot of the people who have been doing work around the issues of policing and who would have organized demonstrations just haven't really been together in a way that they should be in within the city. So it's hard to really say, because in the past couple of years there hasn't been a whole lot happening for International Day Against Police Brutality. So I think, I mean, to put it in the context of post-September 11th, I think it's a real good thing that people are still willing to come out and be in front of police headquarters with loudspeakers, speaking to everyone who passes by on a busy Toronto street, you know, advocating against the police and against the practices of them. So, you know what I'm saying? It's hard for me to compare to look back, but I think today is a good day for all these people to come out, despite the fact that we're in a lovey-dovey, love-the-police kind of environment right now, and people are walking around. I probably counted half a dozen people today wearing new NYPD hats, you know what I'm saying? That kind of stuff, you know what I mean? So, you know what I'm saying? So...
Yeah, well, what would you say is the relationship then between police brutality as you experience it on a local level in Toronto and the increasing militarization that we see in the world today with the war in Afghanistan and build up in Colombia and the Philippines and now going into Iraq?
I mean, I think the one of the big things that you've seen, the way it's changed the role on the street is that different groups of people are getting targeted a lot more because of post-September 11th. And that's the obvious first one to think is because of September 11th, Muslims and Arabs are getting targeted a lot more on the street by police. And I've been hearing stories of things like, you know, I've been hearing stories of things like that happening now more and more. After the first wave of the hate crimes against Muslims and stuff like that, we actually started hearing about police who are harassing people on the street as well. You know what I'm saying? So I think that's part of it. But I think also the idea that you talk about the increase of militarization, the police are always pushing for more technology, more more things like that they can use in the practice. And I think post September 11th, you're going to see a lot more push and a lot more support for those initiatives. And I think that's going to affect the way people on the streets are treated. You know, and we're just seeing it. We're just seeing it start now. And I think, you know, we really need to pay close attention to it over the next little while, because these police forces are getting more and more budgets for things like this, right? More and more budgets for technology. It's going to be affecting those of us who are on the streets, people who live on the streets, people who work on the streets, people who live in low-income communities, people of color. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's going to affect everything across the board, because it's basically just an excuse to give the cops more power and more resources. You know what I'm saying? So,
Chris, what about you out there in Vancouver? How has this increase in militarization in the world impacted police brutality there on the local level?
Yes, I couldn't agree more with Mike's comments in Toronto about using newer technologies. One of the things that's very, very worrying here, not just we're seeing a specific targeting of Latino, especially Latino youth and new refugees and immigrants. You may be aware that Gordon Campbell, our premier, has cut poverty law legal aid. So these folks, if you've got a landlord-tenant issue, have no more recourse to fight those issues in the court. They're cutting welfare, and for new refugees, they're not going to be able to get any welfare at all. So people living on the edges are being pushed over the edges, and often that means the only solution for them to live, which is crime. Now, the technology that's being implemented in BC is horrific. What they're doing in the downtown east side is they're going to be installing 23 closed-circuit television monitors based on the program in Britain, a program that has proven not to stop crime. For example, last year in London, where they have more than 150,000 of these cameras, they had a 40% increase in street crime. Now, the privacy commissioner from Ottawa has been out in BC. He's been complaining because in Kamloops they have these cameras up and operating already. And yet here in Vancouver, even though there's opposition and widespread opposition, they're going to push them through anyway. Our poor people in the downtown east side live in these tiny little rooms called SROs, single room occupancies, these decrepit rat-infested hotels. And what happens is that you can't sit in these little rooms all day. You'd go mad. So they go out in the street in their community where they can socialize with other people, hang out, but now they're going to be under direct surveillance of the state. And we find that incredibly offensive.
I wonder if both of you can comment on the likelihood of overcoming a corrupt armed force in our local communities. I mean, how do you combat something like the police?
Do you want to go first, or do you want me to?
Well, I can say a few words about Vancouver's experience. What we've been arguing for a long time, and a lot of this came out of the APEC events at UBC a few years ago, which was directly related to the opposition to globalization. And also what's called the riot at the Hyatt, when the Prime Minister had come a few years ago and protesters were viciously attacked by an increasingly militarized police. What we've been calling for is a complete structural reform of policing as a first step in Vancouver. And what that means is a model of democratic policing with civilian oversight. Now, at the forum last night on community policing, this issue again was raised, and I couldn't believe how instantly defensive the cops became. And, you know, they stood up basically as one great big cop, and he said, look, you guys don't understand. We cops, we have a social conscience. The way we see it is that there's this big sandbox where you're all playing. You guys got to play fairly, and our role is to referee. Now, I burst out laughing when I heard that because it was incredibly ridiculous, patronizing, looking at us, you know, like we're children. but this is the reaction they give us when we suggest real civilian oversight, where the police will be accountable to the people, where they'll be compelled to focus on crimes against people rather than crimes against property.
Yeah, I think the point of civilian accountability and around the police is definitely a big one too. I mean, that's one of the organizations that was involved in organizing today's demo in Toronto is the Toronto Police Accountability Coalition, and they're working on things like strengthening civilian accountability and civilian overseeing of the police, and that's one real important component towards, you know, keeping the police in check. But I think on a more grassroots level, what I would like to see, and I think, you know, and I live in a low-income community where I grew up, and you see police, and we're seeing police brutality like on a regular basis. I think what we need to do is stop being afraid of the police and start standing up for ourselves as a group. I mean, I know it seems like a simple answer, but that's just the bottom line. I think too is that when we're in the communities ourselves, when you know a group of youth are hanging out, you know, the older people in the community need to stand up for those youth and advocate on support of those youth, and those young people need to advocate on behalf of themselves too. You know what I'm saying? And not let themselves get treated like the way that they're getting treated by the police. You know what I mean? Like the other night, the community I live in Toronto is called Flemington Park, and the other night you know, outside the rec center after one of the programs was done. There's a whole bunch of youth hanging out, and the police came by, and the police started the siren to clear it away and see who would run. You know what I mean? Like, and more times, what happens is those young people will just go home to avoid any kind of a confrontation, right? And then when they separate and single themselves out, then the police go and harass them individually, right? What I think, you know, we need to be willing to stand up as a group and say, we have a right to be here. This is our community. This is our community center. You know what I'm saying? Things like that, too, on that level really need to come together as people who are being affected by the police from the bottom, and then as well advocate on the top overseeing the police. You know what I'm saying? I think it's all those things need to be taken into account to really, you know, put a strong fight back against the police and what they're doing in our communities.
Well, Mike in Toronto and Chris in Vancouver, I want to thank you for joining us today on Off the Hour.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for having us. Good luck in Montreal.
Thank you.
Fight of the nation with their guns and ammunitions. Police and thieves in the street.
Hello. So speaking of refereeing and social change and justice, well, the police, as in the interview before was saying, is that they take on the role of refereeing. And we see this happening more and more often. Well, let's tie it back to Montreal. The fact that in 97, the International Action for Police Brutality started in Montreal is very interesting because this is a way by which we can bring social change and justice and referee the police. Maybe we need to referee the police. Because just the fact that they use this excuse that they're refereeing people, it gives them an excuse to publicly brutalize us. I don't know if this is the correct term or not, but they use it as a way of making excuses for their brutality. And they put it under different contexts and umbrellas. And let's examine this. They're misleading terms that they use. And just the fact, let's look back at Palestine and the occupied territories. Just as everywhere around the world, police takes in people to detain them in prisoners, in prisons, so in the occupied territories, there's always a large scale of detaining people under the excuse of public security. And one of them is, let's remember last week, there was 1,200 Palestinians taken. Yeah, they were looking for only 20 people, but they took in 1,200 people. So let's play on this word of detaining and political prisoners.
Yeah, and the problem arises is when they arrest those people and they never release them, you know, and you don't hear anything about them, and they always refer to them as security detainees, you know,
taken for an indefinite time.
Indefinite time, you know, and they would never get a court. Their family can't see them. A lot of issues, you know, play around.
So the police is all around the world, I can see, is very efficient with using vague terms.
Vague terms, you know, like in the issue of Palestine specifically, you know, it's like they should have been called political prisoners, but just to protect the country from its democratic image, you know, like, you know, it's Israel's democracy, you know. But, you know, that's why they never use the term political prisoners. They use the other term, which is security threats or security detainees, you know.
Because that would take you away from the issue of racism.
Exactly.
But this also makes me think of what's been going on in the rest of the world since September 11th.
Exactly.
What is happening in so-called liberal democratic states like the United States and Canada is that you have this new, like Bill C, what was it?
Bill
C-36 is the same idea, but except that it's been imposed in Israel for the past, we'd say 54 years. Yeah. And now the
rest
of...
What's Bill C-36?
It's basically a bill that's been passed because of so-called the dangers of terror.
Yeah.
And basically it says that they can detain a suspect
For being a suspect.
For being a suspect, but of course not for years and years as in many Middle Eastern countries it happens, but here they can just be suspicious of you and detain you for a few days without your lawyer getting in touch with you. Without, so God knows what happens in between those 7 days. Yeah. And in the United States, it's even longer. And you have, anyways, so...
So can you tell us a little bit about some personal stories that you know of political prisoners or detainees, as they are termed?
Well, again, I'll refer back to children, you know, because this is you know, and children, I find, you know, innocent.
The biggest,
you know,
example.
The biggest examples of, you know,
injustice.
Police brutality and injustice, you know. I would refer to this case specifically... his name is Rami Yasser Zaoul. He's 16 years old, and he got arrested. You know, he got arrested in his village near Bethlehem.
Under what pretensions?
Under what they took Rami? Actually, the story that I have is doesn't really provide anything, but they still hear that they saw the kid throwing stones at the army. That's why they arrested him. And when they came to his house and they took him, they were very rude, very
aggressive
and dealing with the kid. So, you know, it's kind of like very...
So this is usually seen on a wide scale.
And it's probably not unusual right here in Montreal. Dee's on the line with us now, who's from the COBP, that's the French acronym for the Coalition Against Police Brutality, right here in Montreal, which has been demonstrating one at the forefront of the actions against police brutality, the international movement against police brutality, beginning with coordination back in 1997. Dee, are you there?
Yeah, I am.
Can you give us a report on today's actions and maybe run down quickly some of the issues that it's trying to draw attention to?
Where we are right at the moment?
Go right ahead.
Oh, we're still at Berry Square. Actually, one of our members, Alexandre, he's giving a speech right at the moment about what's been happening around the world, you know, because, in certain countries, a lot in Europe, with a lot of the people that are participating this year are people that are defending immigrants, you know, people that are trying to... you know, stop deportations, such as certain groups in Belgium and in France and in Austria. And he's been going on and on about denouncing what's been happening here as well. He's still speaking. I can't approach the demo too much because it's a little loud.
Yeah, I can hear it. It's very, very loud in the background. Dee, can you tell us what's the relationship between fighting against police brutality and working for social change right here in Montreal?
What is CBP doing?
Yeah.
Yeah? Well, we do a lot of things. A lot of people think that all we ever do is just, you know, do an annual march, and that's not just an annual march. We do other demonstrations and everything like that when certain things happen, such as with, in, you know, January 2000, we did something for Jean-Pierre Lizotte. Summer before, there was also when those two men had died from pepper spray. What we do mostly, though, the majority of our work is most of the work that goes unseen. That is, people phone our voice, or they leave a message, they're a victim. And, you know, we meet the victim up, we meet up with the victim. We help them if they want to fill out a form, to go to the Ethics Commission and announce and stuff like this. And we give our honest appraisal of this Ethics Commission, which isn't appraised very highly. We do a lot of workshops, we do conferences, we do interviews, from all over the place, and we also put out a lot of different bulletins. So it's called Infobalue. That is in French only. Then we have Agent Provocata, which is in English and in French. The first one, we talk about specific cases. very, very specific of it, such and such a police officer did such and such a thing at such and such a time. The other one could be a more general about the different abuses of the police here and elsewhere. Because it is a global problem. I mean, even in the Americans, a lot of them are talking about capitalism. This is what they're calling it, capitalism, because of all the massive increases in police budgets. I mean, the Toronto Police just got an extra $50 million, and that's just for this year. So, and this is the budgets are always increasing for the police, and especially with all these new laws, the C-36, C-35, C-42, and also totally racist CLR and the tax immigrants. I mean, they're giving more and more and more monies, hundreds of millions of dollars, to not all types of policing, not just municipal policing, not just provincial and federal, but also to things like CSIS, so they can spy more on activists and on immigrants.
Well, how do you
poor people?
Well, how do you stop it, Dee, with the increasing militarization?
You're going to have to repeat that. I really can't hear you.
How do you stop it, Dee, with the increasing militarization? How can you stop it?
How can we stop it?
There you go.
Okay, well, the only way to stop it is to mobilize on it. We've got, I don't know how many, I'm not very good at judging numbers, maybe about 2, 3, 4, I don't know, hundreds here. And that's good. It's good to put your voice in. You have to get your voice out in the streets, you know. But that's not the only thing. We have to mobilize in many, many different areas. And, you know, like, there's a lot of people that say, well, what can I do? I'm all by myself. One person can't change the world. Well, that's the whole idea. It's not going to take one person. It takes everybody, and everybody's got to do their thing. For example, you're walking down the street, and all of a sudden you see a homeless man, and the police and the homeless are in a really, really bad situation with that, as was in the case that was over in the death of Jean-Pierre Bizot, for example. Now, what you can do is mobilize, go there, you know, you stand there and watch them. Watch what the police are doing. Check it. If you don't have a watch, ask somebody what time, so you can remember what time it is, what corner what happened, and everything like that. I was just at a metro station, and this is not with the metro cops, but the actual MEC police. Yeah? And that was on February 20th at the exit Saint-Denis, and I wrote down whatever I could, all the different information. I was unable, of course, to approach the police, because of the fact that, you know, they were just, like, warning me that I would be arrested. I guess the sound system isn't too good here. but there's things like this. Also, the medical. We do have the 8599065 number. And the thing is like, what a lot of people have done is that they've actually called us and said, hey, listen, I witnessed such and such. This is horrible. I heard this and that. So it's a woman who called not so long ago about a black youth. Not the same incident of with Winston that was brutalized by the Metro cops. But another woman has seen another black man who has been brutalized by Metro cops and the municipal police. But she was out of the debt. She didn't know what to do, but she had just come out of the conference where she had picked up a pamphlet. We had many different pamphlets to discuss all the different things about policing. And there she found.
We're going to have
her back, and we got all the details and everything like that. And then when we put that out and we distribute it, we put it on the internet, and we're trying to break down the myth that, you know, these are isolated problems, because it isn't isolated. It's all over, and you can ask anybody.
We're going to have to cut out, Dee. We've been asking a lot of people tonight. There have been demonstrations happening in New York to San Francisco.
Well, right now, we're walking in the streets, man. I just want to say that. We're walking in the streets. We're going to talk to us. We're going to talk to us. We're going to talk to us. We're going to talk to us.
You've been listening to Off the Hour on CKUT tonight. Hala, you want to close out for us? There's demonstrations happening again around the world. It is International Police Brutality Day. People have risen up in Belgium, Russia, France, Switzerland, Austria, Argentina, New Zealand, across the United States, and right here in Canada. You heard from folks in Alberta, Manitoba, British Columbia, Ontario, and we concluded right here in Quebec, in Montreal. Hold on, Hala, your mic's not up.
Wait. waiting for the microphone.
Now you go.
Great. Thank you very much for being with us today for this edition of Hela Ya Hela. And I want to thank Ahmed Abu Safiya for being with us today. And our sources are from Defense for Children International. This is the Palestine section. And you can find this information all on www.dci-pal.org. That's dci-pal.org. And thank you again.